Quel est le point de mettre?
Hello, wrestling fans, and welcome to Shut Up and Wrestle, a wrestling history podcast about good conversations and great stories. I am your host, Brian R. Solomon. Welcome to episode 118 of the show with my guest this week, a member of our very own Arcadian Vanguard family, the voice himself, Mr. Lou Kippelman. That's right, Lou Kippelman. My guest this week on Shut Up and Wrestle. We'll get to that in just a few moments. Before we do, a couple things that I wanted to talk about. First and foremost on my mind this week is a brand new project that I am launching. I talked a little bit about it online, on Twitter, and in the Shut Up and Wrestle Facebook group. It is the Shut Up and Wrestle Commentaries. What this is I am recording audio commentaries, kind of like the old DVD commentaries, right? Audio commentaries for historic wrestling cards, cards that are widely available online, whether it be through Peacock or on YouTube, things like that. And the idea is you locate the video that it goes with, right? And you locate my audio commentary, which is to be found on the Patreon page for Shut Up and Wrestle. That's patreon.com/shutupandwrestle. Go and subscribe if you haven't. And you will find on that Patreon page the first example of these Shut Up and Wrestle commentaries, which is a commentary to go along with the March 17th, 1975, St. Patrick's Day, 1975, Madison Square Garden show featuring Bruno Sammartino versus Spiros Arion in a Texas death match and other matches. So that first commentary that I've recorded is a free sample to give you an idea of what this project sounds like. So it's basically me sitting there with you, hypothetically, theoretically, watching the show, giving you commentary, giving you history, giving you background, maybe in some cases personal memories and recollections. So the idea for this first one is you find the commentary on the Patreon page, Shut Up and Wrestle, and you play it along with the video for the March 17th, 1975 MSG show, which can be found on Peacock in the WWE Old School section. And you play those at the same time, simultaneously synced up. And hopefully, you will enjoy the finished product, the fruits of my labors. I plan to continue to record these for paid subscribers in the months to come. It's a $5 paid tier on my Patreon. And for that, you will get these monthly audio commentaries for historic wrestling cards. So I encourage you to check it out if you haven't already. It is patreon.com/shutupandwrestle. You can also find the link to the sample on my Twitter profile and also on the Shut Up and Wrestle Facebook group. So, just wanted to plug that. I'm very proud of it. Going to be doing more of those in the months to come. I'll keep you posted. Also wanted to thank everybody at Blood, Sweat, and Tears Wrestling. I took part in their Elevate 2 event at the Devonshire Hall in Hamden, Connecticut on Friday, April 19th. Everything went great. A hell of a show. Hell of a performance put on by the hardworking wrestlers of Blood, Sweat, and Tears Wrestling. That show, if you didn't get a chance to see it live, it's going to be made available on independentwrestling.tv for subscribers there. And I'll let you know when it is available, but thanks to everybody at BST Wrestling. And the last thing I wanted to mention is the new issue of Inside the Ropes magazine number 44 with Triple H and Cody Rhodes on the cover. The victory shot from WrestleMania 40. And if you pick up that issue at InsideTheRopesMagazine.com, or if you're lucky enough to find it at a Barnes & Noble and things like that, you'll find my article on the WWE Hall of Fame Class of 2024. So check that out if you want, digital and print form at InsideTheRopesMagazine.com. Now, let's get to Lou. If you listen to Arcadian Vanguard shows, you know that voice, you know the man, Mr. Kippelman himself. I was proud to finally get him on the show, and we just had a delightful conversation that went everywhere. We talked about famous Hollywood voiceover actors. We talked about the Cauliflower Alley Club. We talked about the history of wrestling in Northern California, WWE's photo archive. You name it, Harley Race as NWA champion in the WWF. All these kind of interesting things are but a few of the many topics that we touch upon in this wonderful conversation that I am about to take you to right now. Okay, so it's my pleasure this week on Shut Up and Wrestle to welcome someone that is really long overdue here on the podcast. I believe he is the last member, the one and only member of the Arcadian Vanguard family who has not been on the show yet. And I did, that's not intentional. I saved the best for last, I assure you. No pressure, Lou. But for people that love the Arcadian Vanguard shows and listen to them, as I'm sure many of you guys do, you probably know Lou as the producer for Stick to Wrestling with John McAdam, as well as Breaking Kayfabe with Boudrin and Barry. He also helps us out quite a bit on the wrestling news, and he can be heard filling in for Mike Sempervivi now and then when he gets a sore throat. He's also someone that I've had the pleasure of partying with in Las Vegas. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. He is the one and only Mr. Lou Kippelman. Lou, thank you so much for finally making it to Shut Up and Wrestle.
Ryan, I just consider it a privilege that I'm able to guest before Boogeyman, not Jimmy Valiant, in the Arcadian Vanguard universe. So, hey.
Technically, though, he did make an appearance, not Boogeyman, when I had...
you're right, when you had Scott on.
Scott on the show, he made a brief appearance. But I understand, I get it. And yes, folks, there is the voice, the much-heralded voice of Lou Kippelman, which I believe we should have a T-shirt made up that says, "For the wrestling news, I'm Lou Kippelman," because that is so over. Even my wife does that line around the house. So when we're listening, because I'll listen back to the show every morning to see how it turned out and all that sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, it's the voice, man. You are just the voice of voices. We love it.
Well, thank you. I wish I could say that I cultivated it, but I'm only using what has been given to me.
Well, that's all we can do in life, really, is utilize the gifts that God has given us to the best of our abilities. And you have that voice. Actually, this doesn't have anything to do with wrestling, but I have to ask you this, because when I was getting ready to have you on, I happen to be on your Facebook page, because we are friends on Facebook, because
indeed
I'm in that lucky inner circle. And you had a website link, loukippelman.com. And I clicked on it to see what was there. And lo and behold, it mentioned that you are also, or have been at least, a voice actor. And I remember thinking, well, clearly this is a line of work that you were made to do, but I had no idea you'd ever done it.
Oh, it's been an aspiration of mine long term. So I could tell you, I do have what used to be called in the olden days of voiceover, I have a reel. Or right. Essentially a demo. I have that. I do have representation. Have I booked anything recently? Nah, not really. But
that's because you're too busy working on these podcasts, Lou. That's what's happening.
Oh, exactly. We gotta keep people updated on when somebody farts in a Japanese ring. So, but. Yeah, it's certainly something I've been meaning to do, and I'm still trying to pursue it here and there, be it Boy, there are a lot of different genres from being the voice on a voice tree for a company. Press one for this, press two for that. Just whatever will get me paid, essentially.
Do they even still use human beings for that? I feel like half of that sounds like it's AI at this point when you know, or what do they call it? Even before AI, there was a certain kind of software, right, where you could actually simulate human voices where it doesn't sound like Stephen Hawking, where it actually sounds like a real voice.
Yeah, you could say there was a program called Dragon, naturally speaking, that may be the one you're thinking of. But yeah, the way, especially the way now that AI is going, I can only assume that it's going to go that way for a lot of these things.
That's
So.
unfortunate. It really is. I mean, I've even noticed, yes, and yes, folks, we will get to wrestling eventually. I even noticed that even in the high profile world of voice acting and the highest realms of it, you know, we don't see anymore of so many of what we used to have, those kind of professional voices. So much of it is celebrities now, people that are, you know, known commodities. You don't get the kind of Paul Freezes of the world anymore, and the you know, those kind of people that you hear the voice, you don't even know the name, and you're like, oh, that guy, that voice, you know?
Exactly. And sidebar, Paul Frees lived in the town where I grew up in Tiburon, California, in Marin County. So he had died by the time I entered high school. I wish I could have ran into him on the street, but yeah, Paul Frees, who was Boris Badenoff, Poppin' Fresh, the Pillsbury Doughboy, did one of the voices for the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland. Just an array of voices. And that's the thing. You have to be a geek like me to know, a Mel Blanc or a June Foray or
Burl Ravenscroft, there's another one for you.
Thurl Ravenscroft.
Tony the
Yes, see,
Tiger.
Tony the Tiger and the singer from The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. People like that, and they were, they didn't have much face recognition to the general public, but they were in the business and they did their jobs really, really well. I'm not sure when it was, maybe one or two decades ago, when they started doing, you might call it stunt casting. So like get whoever's hot, make them do a voice in this movie or that movie, regardless if they can't necessarily translate their own acting skill into the voice work.
I mean, there's always been a little bit of that, especially, I mean, even in the 60s, I'm thinking of like something like The Jungle Book, where it was, you know, Louis Prima, and they had all these famous people. Even then, it was British actor George somebody who did the villain. I forget his name. And
Oh,
George Sanders,
George Sanders.
who had a
Yes,
great
old.
voice. But I mean, still, I don't think it really started becoming all across the industry. I feel like it was the 90s, kind of. I hate to lay this all at his feet, but I feel like it's Robin Williams in Aladdin. Like that was the turning point where they said, this was great. Let's just get all celebrities to do this from now on. He was great, you know?
Exactly. And wow, he was. He was the singularity in terms of being an actor, be it comedic or dramatic, or just an improvisational banshee, and that's what made it work like crazy, and help start that renaissance of Disney animation back then.
But to tie it to wrestling, believe it or not, and to tie it to myself and my books, I'll say this. It's something that I'm fascinated with myself because they called me in to do the audiobook for Blood and Fire. And I had a blast. Not only that, but I mean, they told me this. I can't judge because this was my first time. They told me I was like a machine. Like usually I did it in, I think they said it was less than half the time they typically book. And I'm going, really? It took me like 4 days. And they're like, yeah, that's nothing for something like this. It was, you know, but I did it and I had so much fun that I said to them, hire me. I'd love to do more of these. It doesn't just have to be my own books. And apparently, I mean, it's some kind of a thing where there's unions involved and there's all kinds of, like, you really need to, they can't just kind of give it to anybody. Like, it's a whole process. So I haven't been able to do any more than that, but I would love to do that kind of work.
Well, and I could talk to you after the show about this, but there is a marketplace that Amazon has called the Audiobook Creation Exchange, ACX. And just about anybody can go on that and say that they're a potential reader, a potential narrator. And you just leave a demo of what you can do, and you can audition for certain book projects. Of course, I think it's all pretty much non-union. But there is, it is a huge market with still a lot of need. So I'd say don't give up on that dream just yet.
I won't because I loved it, and I'm looking forward to and fully expecting at least to be able to do it for the new book, Irresistible Force, because I think they really liked it, and I think the audiobook's done well. In fact, I think right now the audiobook is outselling the print book.
Wow.
At this point, because I feel like it wasn't always. I think what happens with these books a lot, you get to the point where when it's a niche kind of market and a niche appeal book, where everyone who wants to get it, got it. Like there's a limit on these things, where that's another reason why, 2 years ago when I was last at Cauliflower Alley Club, I had a table selling those books. And because they had just come out, right? That was 2022, I guess. Yeah, 2022 was the last time I went. And I didn't go to CAC last year. I'm not sure if you did or not. Did you go?
Yes, I did.
I didn't go because they made it for the first week of school, and that was a big problem. I did not want to miss my son's first day of first grade, and neither did my wife, who loves to come with me. And thankfully, I see that I have a feeling maybe there were people who raised a concern over this because they moved it again. Because it's not just, everybody says, well, they're all a bunch of old men. They don't have any kids in school. Yeah, but I'm like, some of those are grandparents that might want to see their grandkids go off. Some of them are teachers. Ross Hart told me, for example, that he couldn't go last year because he's a teacher and he couldn't miss the first week of school. And I'm sure other guys that go are educators of some kind too. So anyway, I'm glad they moved it. They moved it now to mid-August. So
that's
we
right.
will be making our triumphant return, but I don't plan on selling books this time. I'll do it the following year when I have the Gorilla books, but I'm not going to sell any books this time because I feel like I just get the sense from having done a few more of these now that everyone that goes to these kind of things has already gotten it. So I don't really feel like it's a waste of time at that point, honestly.
I think you're right. And I think the, God willing and the creek don't rise, this will be my fourth consecutive CAC reunion. It's of course, like most everything else in civilization, the pandemic kind of knocked it askew. And so in the coming back from that, I want to say it's still trying to find its footing as far as number of attendees and also the number of vendors in the hospitality room. I hope that it comes back to a kind of thriving level, because there are a lot of good things and a lot of good books, a lot of good people selling their photos and whatnot. I hope that it's it thrives even more this coming year.
Well, of course, I mean, it goes without saying a big part of the struggle is, and this is just a statement of fact, I'm not trying to insult anybody, but the attendance is a lot of older people by definition, retired wrestlers and people who are out of the business or towards the end of their career tend to go more than younger people. And those are the people that were most affected by the pandemic, and not only, you know, by the sense of not wanting to really go abroad much anymore. It became a serious problem. And that's why I feel like we enjoy going. We love going to Vegas. It's just fun being there. It's great meeting people and seeing people you don't get to see too much that you work with or know online or whatever. But you do get that sense that you came along like at the tail end of what used to be something really incredible, you know, getting to go and hang out with Luthez and Dick Beyer and Nick Bockwinkel and, you know, all those guys, Gene Kaniski. I mean, like, those
Limp
days,
Bizkit,
those days are done. Those days are done, you know. And it's just, I want the organization to continue on and really find its footing among younger wrestlers, and so that there are people that can take the place of those people. But like when I was there, the last time I was there in 2022, it had started to build back up again. And I remember we were in the, I have no frame of reference here. And we're in the banquet hall, and it felt to me like it was packed, like it was really hopping. And I was talking to somebody who had been to a ton of them. I'm trying to remember who it was. Oh man, who's the guy? He's like a Ron Hutchison.
Yeah.
I was talking to him and he was like, this is nothing. This is nothing compared to how it was. And I'm thinking, I don't even know how you could fit more people in here. That's amazing to me, but I guess that, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Though I do commend CAC for getting in the sort of newer wave of just retired wrestlers and even current workers, that they got CM Punk this past year.
Amazing.
With the Iron Mike Mazurki Award. He just gave an awesome speech. He was there taking photos with whomever wanted a photo and with no, you know, promotional consideration whatsoever. He was just there, you know, to support an organization, which is supposed to be a benevolent association for workers past and present. And getting guys like CM Punk, Bradshaw,
yes,
JBL, Rey Mysterio, Ron Simmons,
RVD.
Heck, you forget RVD. And people like that. And this year there's the Iron Mike Award is going to Sting. So that'll be interesting. And Sting is somebody who's been around the business for the last near 40 years. So I like to think that there's some small germ of you're going to have people who'll be coming in who can continue that sort of fraternization.
Yeah, and I know
that
they
you could see.
Yeah, well, they have a relationship with WWE now, which is good, and they've had that for years, going back to, I guess, when they honored Shawn Michaels, although I know before that, they, you know, going way back into the 90s, there was a year where they honored Vince himself.
Yep.
There was a year, and I learned a lot about this because of the Gorilla book, and talking to Tom Burke, when they used to do it on the East Coast, where they had a whole WWF contingent one year, like Arnold Skolin, Gorilla Monsoon. They all came together. I mean, Blassie was there every year, but like that whole Pedro Morales, you know, the whole like New York crew was there one year. So, I mean, they've been cultivating that. What I like to see, right, is the newer and newer, I mean, you know, wrestlers of later generations getting turned onto it. Like one thing that happened, which I thought was, it was kind of a sad commentary in a way, and I'll say it. I mean, I'm not affiliated with CAC. I could say what I want, but when you were there when Rey Mysterio got his award, right?
Yes, sir.
That was like 2 years ago.
It was.
And he got up there, and he was amazed. He was flabbergasted. And I remember one of the things he said was that he had never heard of the Cauliflower Alley Club. Do you remember that? He just said something to the effect of like, wow, this is amazing. I didn't know that this went on, and I'm going to, and then he started coming every year. Like, I don't know. And JBL too, but it made me think, wow, here's a guy who has been in the industry since the late 80s and has been a superstar for 30 years.
Right.
And he never heard of the Cauliflower Alley Club. If that's true,
Yep.
Something's got to change there. I mean, because if he hasn't heard of it, then a lot of these younger guys probably don't have much awareness of it either.
I know. It kind of blows my mind, too, considering Rey Mysterio is from San Diego. CAC was founded in Los Angeles. They started out having their banquets at the Sportsman's Lodge in Studio City back when the original charter, included stunt people and I think boxers as well.
Even just so, all kinds of actors. James Cagney was a member, which is my favorite. My favorite former member of the CAC. There's a letter that they hang up in the merch room that is a letter from James Cagney to the CAC because he was a member.
Right. And it is interesting to see past events being organized all over the country. And speaking of that one in New Jersey, I don't know if you've ever seen on YouTube a video clip from Late Night with Conan O'Brien back, I don't know, probably mid-90s or so. And it was the sidekick Andy Richter going to CAC.
Oh, yes. I think I have seen this. Isn't Terry Funk in it or Lou Thesz or somebody? Am I thinking of something else?
The one who I can remember who kind of put the button on the whole thing was Lou Albano. Just being Lou Albano and bugging Vince McMahon, too. So,
The story, I know the story of Lou Albano at the CAC. Now, I don't know if he's another one that would go every year. I don't know about that, but he definitely went when they were on the East Coast. And again, the year that the whole WWF crew was there, apparently he was quite a handful. Lou, as a lot of us may have known, he liked the alcohol. He enjoyed imbibing, and he imbibed quite a bit at that banquet, apparently. And the story was that Skoland and Monsoon and those guys were trying to rein him in because I'm not sure if it was the year that Vince was there, but even if he wasn't there, it was like these guys were representing the company and he was out of his mind drunk, basically.
Right. Which is almost seems to be the norm if you hear from his contemporaries.
Yeah, what I love about the Lou Albano for that reason is he's the one and only guy of all of the guys that were the Vince Sr. people that he told Vince Jr., you have to take care of these guys, right? He had this list of guys. He is the only one that was such a problem and such a handful that Vince had to be like, you know what? I don't care what my dad said. You're fired. Like, I can't deal with this, that he had to get rid of him. And that tells you a lot, because I'm sure he had to tolerate a lot of shenanigans from those guys because he promised his dad he would take care of them. But Albano just pushed it too far.
Right. But at least he did seem to clean himself up to some degree when he did the Super Mario Brothers Super Show as Mario. And then he got another chance with the Head Shrinkers.
They did bring him back. That's true. And they put him in the Hall of Fame and the whole thing. But actually, you mentioned something, and this brings me to something that I wanted to speak to you about quite a bit, in addition to CAC, but because I like talking about CAC because it's fun. It was fun spending time there. I'm looking forward to seeing you again in August. But I know you grew up in California, right?
That's right.
Okay.
In Marin County, just north of San Francisco.
Yeah. Right. Okay. And I know for myself, I can't speak for everybody, but I first came to be aware of you thanks to the 605 Super podcast and when Brian would have you on and talking wrestling and that kind of thing. And so I remember hearing a little bit about that. And so if I make you repeat yourself, you'll have to forgive me, but exactly how far back do you go in terms of I'm not trying to date you or age you at all, but do you remember the Shire promotion? I mean, how far back do you go as a fan?
Right. Oh, no worries. I am, I came into my fandom a few years after the Shire promotion folded. So I was 12 years old. It was 1984. And I'll do the math for you. I'm 52.
Gotcha. I figured it
Sure.
out before you. I'm quick. I'm quick.
Yes, I would expect no less from you. And I was just, I was in the 8th grade, home from school, channel changing, and I put on channel 26, which 99% of the time was multicultural, various Asian language programs. But for 1 hour on Friday afternoons, it was AWA's All-Star Wrestling. And before that, I didn't really catch wrestling as it was. The Shire program was on one of the independents when I was growing up, Channel 44 on weekends. And I don't recall ever watching it. And I think my parents, my mom in particular, frowned on the pageantry and display of pro wrestling.
I'm sure she described it differently, but
Right, exactly. And so I turned on AWA All-Star Wrestling, and it's the you're not going to see it from the zoom from the camera here, but I'm wearing my Bruiser Brody t-shirt.
I do see it.
And yeah. And so my first the thing that hooked me was seeing King Kong Brody on All-Star Wrestling. He took care of some tomato can, and then later on, Jim Brunzell had a match, and Greg Gagne's tag team partner was there watching on. And near the end of the match, here comes Brody with Adnan Alkasi, and he just tears apart the High Flyers. I think he might have kicked or punched Jim Brunzell in the nuts. Because he did end up having, I want to say, hernia surgery after this. So that was probably a storyline way to get him out of action.
Okay.
And then, yeah, and then Adnan Alkasi held down Greg Gagne by the legs, and Brody did his trademark knee drop onto Greg Gagne's leg, and boom, he was out. Come back on TV on crutches and stuff like that. And I'm like, this guy, oh my God, who this is. I was, that was the dude who hooked me. And then, I would see the others. This was just post Hogan, AWA.
Right.
So it was still
They had a couple of good
kind of
years still
good.
left.
That's true. And they were about to enter the Pro Wrestling USA period. But they had Bockwinkel, Heenan, they had Curt Hennig coming up. They had the Baron and the Crusher.
The babyface Nazi, Baron von Raschke, yes.
Yeah, I know. That still
It's so
bends my
weird.
mind. Well, it was funny. I was so used to Baron von Raschke as a face that when they started showing Jim Crockett NWA in 86, there was a Von Raschke came on there, and he's managed by Paul Jones. And I'm like, what, the Nazis a heel now? What? How dare they?
I love the fact because, I mean, of course, you also had Fritz Von Erich, who, became a baby face. But I feel like the difference with Von Raschke was he changed very little about his act. Like Fritz Von
Right.
Erich was just basically a guy. He just became a guy from Texas. But Raschke would still be doing he'd still be goose stepping across the ring and
Exactly.
they'd be cheering for him. It's just wrestling is so weird. It's one of those things you just can't explain it to people. Like I think. I forget who I was talking to someone about this on here. We were talking about some of the Nazi wrestlers and how there was a pinup in one of the wrestling magazines of one of these guys, and he had like an iron cross, and he might have had a swastika, I don't know. But the
Right.
idea of how in the world would you explain to somebody why you had that posted up on your wall? You know what I mean?
Oh,
It's
exactly.
you can't
Yeah.
explain this to people.
Yeah, here's a centerfold from the wrestler with Kurt Von Browner or whoever. Yeah.
Strange
That's
thing.
crazy. Yeah. I mean, and I guess the Shire territory had its own share of Germanic characters, though I think they tended to steer more towards the Japanese enemy, though, the Asian Pacific audience base in San Francisco was sizable, you know, where you had Afa and Sika on Hawaii, who just first started going to the Cow Palace to see Peter Maivia in action. Right. And that they got so swept up in it that they were going after guys like Pat Patterson and wrecking the, you know, security or cops, whoever was trying to, you know, hold things down there, to the point where I guess Peter Maivia said had to smarten them up and get them in the business. That's so that would be not such of a headache for Roy Shire. So
yeah, that whole contingent was, they were kind of clustered around the Bay Area for the longest time. Like, I think Dwayne Johnson was born in Hayward. He was born in that area, but near San Francisco, because at the time, Rocky Johnson was wrestling in that Northern California territory. And of course, you had his wife, who was, you know, her father was a mainstay there. Yep. It's just, you know, there was a lot of that comes out of the San Francisco area.
Yeah. And in fact, around that time, Rocky was also tagging with Peter Maivia. I think they held the territory's version of the world tag team titles during that time. And he was also big in LA too previously. So yeah, it's kind of a fun, you know, sort of factoid to say, yeah, The Rock was born in Hayward and his beginnings were there before they went to Florida. So
there must be, and maybe you'll know this, I don't know, but there must be some type of a wrestler, or there must have been some type of wrestler enclave in Hayward, because Gorilla Monsoon lived there when he was working that territory as well, which I discovered. And in fact, I'm trying to think, she'll kill me if I get this wrong. His daughter, Valerie, she was born out there. Uh-huh. No, she was born while they were still in the LA territory, because they were living mm-hmm. like near Venice Beach at the time. And then they moved up. And when he was working in San Francisco, they lived in Hayward. So I don't know if it was just kind of a thing that the wrestlers lived in Hayward, or if there was one of those, you hear about sometimes those apartment complexes full of wrestlers, you know, if it was that kind of thing, right. I don't know.
Absolutely. I know Ray Stevens at various times in his life lived in Hayward. In fact, that's a city where he passed away. And you had other guys, I want to say the Valiant Brothers, during the short time they were in the Shire territory, I think were in Hayward. And guys like Moondog Maine as well. Hayward geographically is in the East Bay and situated not too far from kind of anywhere on the territory loop, be it, you know, the Cow Palace to Richmond in the East Bay, Oakland, San Jose, and I think the occasional spot show over the Santa Cruz Mountains into Santa Cruz and Watsonville and Salinas. So it was, I'm sure at the time, was a relatively inexpensive place to stay. Though with Baldrin and Barry, they got to talk to Jimmy Garvin, who spent time in the Shire territory, but not as a worker, but working behind the scenes, helping Terry Garvin promote a few of the towns when they were in like 73. And Jimmy was, he was raving about a place called Redwood City, which is on the San Francisco Peninsula, which, you know, he had fond memories of that too. But, you know, and maybe, yes, I am biased, but just about anywhere in the Bay Area is a good place to live.
And, you know, I always forget that the AWA was running there. For some reason, that always leaves my memory that they had that period where they were starting. And I guess it was because it was kind of vacant, because the Shire group was either wasn't running that much or was just done, that they started to move in and run San Francisco, which, of course, is really far away from their base of operations.
Absolutely. And, it's just kind of the decline and fall of Roy Shire's promotion is just kind of a funny puzzle in that in mid-1979, He stopped doing his own TV program. And then from there, he imported TV from other promotions, starting with Don Owen in Portland. And he brought in, there was a lot of overlap with workers from Portland in San Francisco. After a few months, then it was, of all places, Bob Geigel's promotion in Kansas City for a few months in like 79, 80.
So
And
when,
then,
yeah, no, go on, sorry.
oh, no problem. And then after that, in the end, it was a few months with Eddie Graham's promotion in Florida, if you could believe it, that they got the top guys from Florida, like Dusty Rhodes and Barry Windham and whoever, to fly into San Francisco. Just for at that point, Shire dropped his whole territory circuit and just did shows at the Cow Palace.
So basically, then I guess what he was doing was he would use the TV from this other territory, and then he would bring their guys in for Cow Palace shows. Is that what he was doing?
And that AWA started running TV in late 1980, which I want to say probably October or November, a couple of months before they ran their first show in January of 81. And their first show, they brought in two legendary figures from the territory, Ray Stevens and Pat Patterson. And they were up against East West Connection, Adrian Adonis, and Jesse Ventura. And so they and their in the main event was a battle royal. So they certainly, I think, if they didn't cast the death blow on the Shire promotion, they tripped over the plug.
But then there was that period there where the AWA and the WWF were fighting over San Francisco, right? They were doing, I think it was almost, they were doing alternate cards at the Cow Palace, right? There was a struggle for that city.
That's right. The AWA started at the Oakland Coliseum, which was at the time home of the Warriors. And because Roy Shire had a grip on the Cow Palace. I'm not sure when the AWA started at the Cow Palace. I want to say somewhere maybe 82, 83. Pardon me. But the WWF, they first started their TV, I want to say in San Jose in mid-83. They had been running for about 6 months in the LaBelle territory in Las Vegas. No, Los Angeles, pardon me. And they held
That's
their
okay,
first.
because I think the LaBelles were also running in Vegas, weren't they? I think they
Right. And
were.
Shire was for a period of time as well.
Right.
The WWF, I think, had their first Bay Area show at the single A San Jose Giants ballpark, outdoors in San Jose. And I want to say the main event was Pat Patterson against Alexius Smirnoff. So it kind of went from there to, I don't know when they first started on Bay Area, on San Francisco TV, but I want to say I started seeing them around mid 84. So.
Alexis Smirnoff, that's a funny one, because I guess apparently he was there. He was with Vince for about 5 minutes, and I guess it must have been around that time. I never knew this until when I was working at WWE, and when I would spend a lot of time, as a lot of people like me would if they came to work there, in their photo archive. In those days, they didn't have any of it digitized, and in fact, the photographers were just start, was still shooting film, I think, when I started there in 2000. And they would have these, I don't know what it's like now, I have no idea, but they have these gigantic file cabinets full of hanging folders full that were full of prints, but mostly contact sheets with the little tiny slide exposures. It looks almost like you're showing your summer vacation pictures,
And
those kind of things.
you got to go over them with a jeweler's loop
Yeah,
just
we
to
call it that, right? The
magnify them.
loop on the light table and the whole thing. And so I would just, for my own entertainment, of course, I would go through these sometimes just to see what was in there. Just like a dream come true for me, just pulling out the thing and going, "Oh yeah, these are the shots from WrestleMania 3. Awesome, I've never seen that one before. Oh wow, I see why they never used that one." Like doing all that, and every now and then I would come across a folder, because they would have folders for different talents. So like if you wanted, they would have it organized in many different ways. They would have by major shows. But if you wanted to find Jake the Snake Roberts pictures, like he had his own folder and all that kind of stuff. And so I would look, and every now and then I would come across a folder and I would go, he was here? When was this? And one of them was Alexis Smirnoff. Another one was Buzz Sawyer, who I didn't know at the time had been there.
Yes, who was known not as a mad dog, but the bulldog.
Right. And I look, you know, I would come across these folders and go, when were they here? But the slides were dated, so I could see exactly when they came through.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That it's would like, be interesting.
Did you find, like, the headbanger Joe LaDuke?
I did, yes. I found Joe LaDuke. Oh, man. There were others like that, especially because I was a lot younger back then. So I didn't have as much awareness of some of these guys being there. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember even being surprised at the time that Bill Eady had been the Masked Superstar, which of course now I realize that. I mean, he was a main eventer. I mean, they used him quite extensively, but I was not aware of that at that time. I just remembered when he came in with Demolition, or the Machines. That would be my first awareness of him coming to the WWF. But you know, I would find those kind of things, and it was an education looking through those folders sometimes.
Yeah, and just to steer back to Alexia Smirnoff for a second, he was somebody who worked in Shire's territory and then lived in the Bay Area in, you know, wait for it, Hayward. Had a wrestling school as well. So, you know, I think naturally when the WWF expanded to the Bay Area, he was a natural to work the local cards, and then he did some work nationally on their TV with them too.
Yeah, apparently he did. And that was, I guess that was one of the key markets for them. It's interesting when you look at how that expansion worked, because I have this theory about it. I mean, I don't think it's that brilliant of a theory. It seems pretty obvious, but you know, the first places they would go, that Vince would go, would tend to be obviously places where there wasn't much happening, you know, like St. Louis, the promotion was dying. Los Angeles, it was dying. San Francisco, it was dead. Detroit, it was dead in Detroit for years. So that's how it started. And then I feel like he got significantly more aggressive after his father died. And I really firmly believe that is not a coincidence. I'm not saying that he wouldn't have done those things if his father was alive, but I think it would have played out differently. I think it would have been more of a conflict. I think it would have been more tumultuous. I think it would have been, he would have been a little, not quite as aggressive. I really do, because there were things he did that he wouldn't have done. Like even Hawaii is another example. Like apparently Vince Sr. had made a promise to Leah Maivia that they weren't going to go there.
Oh.
And they did. It took them a while, but they did. In 86, they started going there. And so I really do think that he was being nice because of his dad. Nice is a relative term with Vince, but I mean, he was holding back. That's another reason why I was talking to John and Steve about this, Sick to Wrestling, where I said that, you know, look at what happened with Backlund, right? After he loses the title to the Sheik, he's still around for like 6 months. Yeah. And he's in main events. He's main eventing the Garden. They're still doing vignettes with him. He's tag teaming with Hogan. Vince Sr. dies, and 2 months later, they drop him like a bad habit, and he's on opening matches against Salvatore Bellomo. You know, these things are related. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure he couldn't help but be a little circumscribed by, you know, having Vincent James McMahon looking over his shoulder, even for that, you know, that brief period of time, that like 18 months.
Right.
Where at the end of his life. But yeah, at least not going hard into the territories of the compadres there of the elder McMahon.
Yeah, I don't know how it would have played out. I mean, the way the details of it, like I told the story that I guess I was the first person to tell it, but it wound up in the Abraham Reisman Vince McMahon book, and I recounted it on the Vice TV special that we did on Vince McMahon, the Nine Lives of Vince McMahon, where Vince himself told me this, that he finally had it out with his dad. I don't know if I told the story on here before, where his dad was, I don't want to say undermining him, but second guessing him. His dad would be kind of double talking and going to some of the other promoters and saying, you know, I'll smooth it out with Vinny. Don't worry, we'll deal. And Vince eventually lost his patience with this and said, look, I'm doing this with you or without you. You work for me now. You know, this is my company now. And are you with me or not? And that's when Vince Sr. said, yeah, you know what, Vinny, you're right. Fuck those guys. That was the line that I used on the show. I don't curse a lot on here, but it was warranted. Yeah, where he said, Vince told me this. He said, and other people have confirmed that, I guess it's popped up in a couple of wrestling books that apparently there was some type of a heated meeting with Vince Sr. and Jr. that took place having to do with Backlund and Hogan or something. And it might have been then that it happened where Vince Sr. just kind of paused and he made the choice that he was choosing his son over the other promoters. So that apparently did happen, but it makes you wonder what would have happened if he had been alive. Because, I mean, if he had been healthy, you know, I don't even think he was 70. He was maybe barely 70. He was younger than Vince is now. I mean, he could have lived, God, into the Attitude Era. I mean, his wife Juanita did. Who knows?
Right. So I wonder if that big fateful moment there, if that preceded the McMahons dropping out of the NWA in 83.
Right. That would have been at the 83 convention, which I guess would be like August 83, maybe, or something like that. And it was them, Barnett, which had to be the shock of all shocks because he was booking the world champion. And I think he was the treasurer, and he walked out, and there was someone else that was connected to that I don't remember who quit. And that's when they knew that the game was over, or that there definitely was a war coming. When you have all those people dropping out, because a lot of people don't realize that the WWF rejoined the NWA in, I think it was right after.
I want to say 71.
Right. You know, and which again is so transparent because it's like right after they lose Bruno.
Yeah.
Because they kind of needed the NWA a little more again. You know, when they have Bruno as champion for 8 years, why on earth do they need the NWA? Why on earth would they even care about acknowledging the NWA world champion? But then they rejoined in 71, and they were members for, I guess that would be about a dozen years after that.
Ryan, I know. And it's still going on Peacock and watching the old championship wrestling episodes. Where they had Harley Race on, having non-title matches. I was like, what weird alternate universe is this? I got so lost in the sauce of 1980s and beyond WWF that I could never imagine that happening. And then also what surprised me is they almost like a level of disrespect they gave to Harley Race and the NWA title. Just that episode of Championship Wrestling where he has a match, he goes and does an interview with Bruno. Right in the middle of it, seemingly arbitrarily, Vince McMahon just says, well, that's enough of that. We'll be back.
Yes, I noticed that too.
Mid-interview.
I noticed that too. And I was talking to somebody about that. It may have been on the show about how I feel that there had to be some conflict going on. Because the thing is, the WWF never really needed the NWA, truly needed them. And I feel that the NWA more needed the WWF. They wanted to have that huge section of the country and to have the influence and power of Vince McMahon Sr. as part of their organization. And so I do think, and especially with Vincent K. McMahon, there was very little patience for all that kind of thing. You can just tell. It was strange bedfellows because, like you said, Harley Race shows up. He's the NWA world champion. And I'm thinking, for the fans watching this, unless you read wrestling magazines, what does this mean to you? Like, did they, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't watching at the time. Did they have any clue who this guy was or that his title was important? You know, what level of awareness would they have even had? It certainly wasn't treated that way on TV. And like you said, I noticed that interview spot where they just cut him off for no reason. And there's a lot of that going on. Like, I remember, because I got caught watching all that 80-81 championship wrestling. I noticed little things like when Pedro Morales first came back at around that time, the first time he comes out, they introduce him as former heavyweight champion of the world, Pedro Morales. And then not long after that, they start introducing him as former World Wrestling Federation heavyweight champion. And I feel like there had to be this political back and forth going on between the New York office and the NWA on how things were supposed to be handled. I really feel like there was conflict there on how these things were going to be talked about or presented. You know, it doesn't feel harmonious to me.
No, it doesn't.
And because just, you know why, and I mean, mm-hmm. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
oh, no
this,
worries.
I want this popped in my head, but because you could tell that in other territories, when the NWA World Champion would show up, all of a sudden the entire universe would revolve around the fact that this person was here. When Harley Race shows up on Championship Wrestling, it's like he's just another wrestler with some belt. I don't, you know, what is this belt supposed to be? Like, it's not treated in any way like he was treated anywhere else he went.
Right, exactly. And it just had him just going through guys like, Steve Travis, yes. guys like that. And, you know, I guess the original timing was they brought Race into MSG in mid-78 or late 78, which would have been early on in Backlund's reign as champion. So I don't know if maybe they were just trying to hedge their bets, see if the, you know, how the All-American boy would bring in, you know, pack the house.
I know he had the match against Backlund at the Garden.
Yep.
As champion versus champion.
Yep.
They brought Harley Race versus Dusty Rhodes to the Garden.
Yep.
Which is weird to see if you've ever seen it, because the match has none of the heat or excitement that Dusty Rhodes matches, say, with Superstar Graham at the Garden have, which are just on fire.
Exactly. And they stopped it for blood on Dusty.
Yeah.
It's like Dusty bleeds when he, you know, frowns. So what the hell kind of thing is that?
And I think there were a couple of others. I think Harley Race defended against Tony Garea at the Garden, if I remember right. There might have been one more, but there never was an angle around him coming in. It was just sort of a random appearance or match or whatever. There never was, because in other territories they would have him tangle with, you know, the top star, or, you know, do whatever, take out a bounty on somebody or whatever. There wasn't much beyond just him getting on the mic and saying, you know, I'm the real world champion. Backlund is, you know, a pretender. He's a regional champion, and I'm going to prove it. And that was essentially all there was to it. It was just really an afterthought.
Yeah. And the only one thing they did was a championship wrestling with Backlund in street clothes coming in and being introduced by Joe McHugh and, you know, doing the handshake and Race holding on and pulling Backlund to him, that sort of intimidation tactic. And that was the only interaction, as far as I know, that happened between the two.
They did a lot more from what I've seen. They've handled it a lot better in Florida when the WWF champion Superstar Graham went down there.
Mm-hmm.
That was huge with the press conference and turning it into a really felt like a special kind of sporting event. But again, that was Eddie Graham doing that. That was not Vince McMahon. So it was just handled in a different kind of way. And I think what was I going to say that Race was the only NWA champion who came through at all. None of the other ones did. Briscoe as champion never came through. Terry Funk never came through as champion.
Right.
None of them. Dusty Rhodes didn't, which would have been amazing to bring him in 81 when he was the world champion. Even,
yeah.
I mean, they still would have had a chance before Vince took over to bring in mm-hmm. Flair. Why in the world? Could you imagine Ric Flair versus Bob Backlund at Madison Square Garden? I mean, that was money left on the table.
Exactly. And we know kind of what happened with their match in Atlanta, that 4th of July in 81, where I guess it was just a political schmoz, and nobody was satisfied with that, how that turned out.
And there's no video of it that's ever turned up. But I was lucky enough. I found a wrestling magazine, which I have, which contains an eyewitness description of the match, pretty much blow by blow,
Okay.
where you can really get a sense of how it went down and what happened. But there are a lot of, there are a lot of matches like that where there's no video, but you can go by newspaper accounts or magazine accounts or whatever. I even have a few that are going into the Gorilla book, which I'm very proud of because that whole period is such a mystery because there's no video footage. There's no film at all of Bruno Sammartino versus Gorilla Monsoon. None. And yet we
Wow.
hear about how legendary these matches were. Well, I was actually able to uncover real descriptions by real news reporters, on what it looked like. And I put all that in the book. So I'm kind of psyched about that.
Yeah, well, needless to say, I'm definitely looking forward to that coming down the road. What do you say, in about a year and a half or so, it's supposed to.
Yeah, I had to push it back a little bit just because of life and everything. I was
Sure.
originally supposed to deliver the manuscript next month, which is not going to happen. And now it's look, my new due date is September 30th, with the book actually coming out in October of 2025, which is
Okay.
similar to what happened with the Sheik book, where they could we if we wanted to get it out for summer 2025, probably, but I think they want it as a Christmas release. And also, it takes a lot of time. They you want to get it right with the photography and the layout and all that. I'm actually going back to Maureen Morella, Mrs. Morella's home over the summer to scan photos, and also, fingers crossed, to interview her for this podcast, which is the first time I've said this officially. But
Okay, well, knock on wood for that.
I'm gonna save it, though. That's the thing,
Yeah.
until the book comes out, because I don't know how often I'm gonna get out there. So since I'd like to do it in person, I'm gonna do that. And I don't want to run it right away because a lot of the things I know that she's gonna talk about are things that will be in the book. So I don't want it to be, to spoil some of the great stories and things in the book. So because
Yeah.
she's amazing. I've interviewed her several times and she's a wonderful person.
Yeah, I for one am looking forward to reading the story of how this guy came in and got himself figured into the wrestling business. Because, my first memory of him is just being this hulking guy with a weird name on, doing announcing.
Right.
But to, hear about his upbringing and then his entry into the Northeast wrestling, and then the way that he gained political power, I guess. It's going to be much the same way that it was eye-opening to see, to read about Ed Farhat in your book.
Yeah, well, I yeah. No, I was going to say I think that's the chapter I'm actually up to right now, which is the period where he really kind of buys into the promotion and how that happened and how he got his percentages and everything. And I'm really leaning into his Italian ethnic heritage. One, I'm doing that for a couple of reasons. I know I'll be explaining this when the book comes out. One is that I am half Italian and that appeals to me. And the other is that I feel like it's a way of reclaiming something because he was never allowed to be publicly Italian. And he was a very, very Italian American man from South Jersey, the whole deal. He was very Italian. Everyone that taught, he spoke Italian. He sung, he listened to opera. He sung, he loved Sinatra and Tony Bennett, the whole thing, and he was, you'd come to his house and he'd have meats and cheeses and he'd be making lasagna, I mean, he was very Italian. His parent, his dad was born there, so he's interesting to me because you had all these Italian wrestlers at the time, and that was part of their character. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't do that. He wasn't allowed to do that. In a way, it's like Chief J. Strongbow's in that category, too.
Sure.
He couldn't be himself because they were like, you know, we got too many Italians. We don't need any more. Not to mention, if we make you Italian, you're going to be a babyface. We don't have any Italian heels. All the Italians are good guys. We want you to be a heel. So they turned him into something so far from what he actually was, that in this book, I really want to explore that part of him that people didn't publicly know, fans didn't know.
Like I can imagine Vince the Elder talking to, I don't know, Red Berry and say, you know, Vince always wanted to give these guys Irish names. So it's like, how about a monster from Ireland? No, that won't work. How about, you know, throw a dart on a map? Oh, Mongolia.
Manchuria, yes.
Oh, Manchuria. Right. Okay. Forgot about that.
Well, yeah, he made Hogan Irish, inexplicably.
He turned Bob Orton into Rocky Fitzpatrick.
Right. Rocky Fitzpatrick, yeah.
Frank Gooding became Bruiser Frank Brody.
That's right. And he named Bruiser Brody, too. I forgot that. He did name Bruiser Brody, who is going to figure into the book because apparently, I guess... Right. He was one of the only people that couldn't get along with Gorilla Monsoon, which is a very small list of people, short list.
Exactly. We've had guests on Stick to Wrestling who, I guess, were in the crowd in either Philadelphia or Hamburg when, I guess, Brody had a little set to with Gorilla when Gorilla was just, you know, backstage running the taping.
And I'm going to tell you something. That particular episode of Stick to Wrestling, I know exactly the one you're talking about. I am going to be quoting and citing from that episode in the book because the account, I forget the guy's name, but I might ask you to put me in touch with him. The account that, if you can, the account he gives is very unique. And I'm not saying that to cast doubt on it or anything, but it's not anything that I have ever heard or read anywhere else. Like you'll hear people say, oh yeah, we heard there was some type of a fight, or a lot of people will say it was just an argument. And I also have the belief that there was probably more than one incident that got heated. I talked to Kevin Sullivan, who was in those locker rooms at that time, who said that he didn't remember any physical fight, but he did remember them getting in each other's faces, getting, you know, I think it might have approached CM Punk, Jack Perry levels of that sort of thing, of getting in each other's faces, maybe a little shove here and there, but not an out-and-out fight. And so listening to that show where the guy, I forget his name, but he talked about seeing Brody punch Gino in the face and break his glasses. I mean, that was just mind-blowing to me because, I mean, it's very specific details that – so no one's going to just make up, you know, so it lends credence to me of that story. So I'm going to at least reference that in the book for sure.
Yeah. Usually I'm good with names. I want to say,
I'll look it up. It's fine.
Yeah. it might've been Randy, but anyway, yeah, it's certainly, yeah, I'm glad you're going to be citing that, using that. That's that was an interesting tale.
Well, it definitely makes me, it makes it believable as to why they never brought Brody back. You could sort of see that. And the funny thing, and of course, there was always that urban legend that it was Gorilla who put the hit out on Brody in Puerto Rico. There has been that legend out there. Because he had a percentage of that territory, which is patently ludicrous, but that is out there.
Yeah.
And in fact, when it came up, when the name of Brody came up in the interview with Mrs. Morella, I brought up the name just because I guess I wanted to get her sense of like what she remembered. She wasn't really well keyed into a lot of the wrestling stuff. She really was like a wrestling wife. She knew, you know, she was good for family things, but business, she wasn't that clued in on. But I do remember, well, first of all, she and Gorilla are the godparents of Jose Gonzalez's children. So bet you didn't know that.
I did not.
Yeah, because that also fed into all these rumors, because Gorilla was very close with a lot of the Latino wrestlers, specifically the Puerto Rican wrestlers. He was sort of like a godfather to them. So it created this whole thing. And when I brought up Brody's name, I just mentioned his name. And she said something like, "Listen, I just want you to know he had nothing to do with that." That was the first words out
Oh,
of her mouth,
okay.
because I guess she's heard those stories too. And there were other people saying how, I think I talked to, who was it that I talked to? Hugo Savinovich, who said that he was absolutely devastated, Gorilla, when he, because I think he had already divested himself out of the promotion by that point.
Sure.
He'd given his points to Victor Quiñones, and he was like absolutely beside himself, like apparently on the phone. How could you let something like this happen? The whole nine yards. But it is an interesting connection, and it's one of the urban legends that I'm going to be happy to debunk in the book, including the fact that Victor Quiñones was not his son. I'm going to take great pleasure in
Yes.
annihilating that very persistent rumor and legend.
Very good. Nothing like a good thorough debunking to.
Oh, right. Oh, what do they call it? A rumor killer, right? I'm going to be a
Yes.
rumor killer for this, with this book. I don't know how we got to talk about me for so much of this show in my book, but no one ever asks me questions about what I'm doing, so this is fine by me. I don't mind.
Hey, that's yeah, my own story. Whatever.
Well, I have to ask this though, but before I know we're running out of time, but I did want to ask, I don't know if you've ever spoken about this, but how did you really get involved with Arcadian Vanguard, and specifically with producing the shows? Because like I said at the top of the show, it's Stick to Wrestling and Breaking Kayfabe. And I also, what fascinates me about Stick to Wrestling is the, and I don't know if it's also with Breaking Kayfabe, is the fact that you produce it live is wild to me. How, sometimes John will be talking about something and you're like the voice of God. You'll just appear and make a comment on something because you're literally producing it live. I mean, how did all that come to be?
Well, I can attribute it to nothing but, if not pure serendipity. This goes back to the first couple of years of 605. Brian Last did once a year a listener trivia contest. And so, of course, because it wasn't necessarily like a live radio thing, he had listeners, send in their interests via Facebook. And by that time, I had gotten onto the gotten interested in 605 through Jim Cornette, the Jim Cornette Experience. So I just sort of got exposed to this weird, wacky world of 605 and just instantly got drawn into it. So this would have been the second trivia listener contest, and I happened to get picked. I was on there. It was Brian and Howard Baum who were going back and forth, and Howard and I knew a little bit of each other from the Arcadian Vanguard Facebook groups, stuff like that. And I gotta put Howard over. He set me up rather well to make a I guess a memorable appearance. I didn't win anything in the, well, I won a production job, but that was later. So, but I guess there was enough positive feedback off that. Brian got back to me later, of course, because I had told him incidentally that I was trying to get in good. To say, I can call in, you can call me on my cell phone, or I know you do Skype. I have like a pro mic setup, because at that point I was taking broadcasting production classes here at the City College in San Francisco. So You know, I said, if you want the real deal set up here, I'm happy to do that. So he called me on my cell phone, but later on he remembered that I had that option, and he wanted me to do the de facto narration for what he called Pandemonium Theater,
Yes,
which
I
was
remember.
that god-awful screenplay that surfaced, that was supposed to be a biopic of Vince McMahon.
Right.
So I got to, coming from a theater background, I got to have a lot of fun with that.
I
And
think you were, weren't you Vince Senior on there, if I remember right, or?
was I, mainly I was a guy, doing the stage directions, you
Oh,
could
right.
call
Okay.
them.
Okay.
So I got to, be the Greek chorus occasionally.
That's
And
right.
so not long after that, Brian said to me, "Well, I know you're, doing audio production and stuff. Would you have any interest in taking on a couple of the podcasts?" And I'm like, "Oh, hell yeah, that'd be great." So I started off with Breaking Kayfabe, then Stick to Wrestling not too long after. And then eventually there were other shows in the portfolio that I got to work with too, being John Arezzi, Studcast with Ron Fuller, and also briefly with Kentucky Fried Wrestling with Scott Baudrin, God rest his soul.
Yes.
So it was definitely a well-rounded experience. I had the opportunity to learn on the job, and five years and some change later, I'm still at it. So I feel fortunate in that
And
regard.
you do a terrific job, I have to say.
Oh, thank you.
On all the shows, it's Stick to Wrestling in particular is a show that I never miss. I've told John and this as well. I've told Steve this, and I feel like Steve is sort of like at this point the unofficial co-host of the show. So I can say John and Steve. I hope John doesn't
Oh,
mind that. But
yeah.
those guys are doing such a great job. It's a great show. Like I said, I look forward to the drop every Friday. Listen to it as quickly as I can. I love it, and
Absolutely.
you do great work. And of course, like we said at the top, for people that want to check it out, I mean, again, I feel like it's redundant. I feel like if you're listening to this show, you know this already. But Breaking Kayfabe, Stick to Wrestling, and of course, the Wrestling News are the places to check out the work of Lou Kippelman.
There you go. Yeah, that sums it up.
And I'm gonna have you just say it one last time, your wrestling news line, if you don't mind, and maybe we could wrap it up like that. I think that'd be perfect.
Okay.
I'm putting you on the
Wow.
spot.
Oh my God. Yeah, there goes my journalistic cred. Okay. I'm whoring out my tag. Okay. For the wrestling news and Shut Up and Wrestle, I'm Lou Kippelman.
Perfect. There you have it, folks. My conversation with Lou Kippelman. Lou, thanks so much for taking the time out from all your hard work as a producer here at Arcadian Vanguard. It is so appreciated. I'm so glad we had the time to have that conversation, and I'm also glad that I could share it with all of you. And I also hope that you'll check in next week for episode 119, because my guest is going to be a guy who's kind of been making the rounds here on a lot of wrestling podcasts, including some of our own. He's been on the Jim Cornette Experience and Stick to Wrestling. Now he will be on Shut Up and Wrestle for a different kind of conversation. I'm talking about Brad Baluchian, the author of the brand new book, The Six Pack: On the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania. He's going to be my guest next week. You don't want to miss that one. You also might not want to miss some of the other stuff I have coming up, because I continue to put together these fantastic interviews and conversations for you guys. I want to tell you that I have a From the Archives interview coming up. I've mentioned it before. It's a two-part 2006 interview that I did with Rowdy Roddy Piper. It's a long one. I'm breaking it up into two parts. That's coming up on the way, as well as my second edition of the WWE Employee Roundtable. I've got a rather self-indulgent episode featuring my very own wife, Jamie, which I think you're going to find very, very amusing. Got some other ones in the works yet that I haven't recorded but are scheduled. Going to be talking to the legendary commentator Kevin Kelly, as well as Vince Fahey, the founder of Kayfabe Memories, a website that I know has been near and dear to the hearts of so many of us. That's some of the stuff that I have in the works, so please do keep checking back on the show. You can find us at our website, suawpod.com, as well as wherever podcasts are to be found. Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Podcast Addict, Podbean, you know the drill. While you're at it, check out the Facebook page, Shut Up and Wrestle with Brian R. Solomon. And if you are inclined to make a financial contribution to the show, that would be so deeply appreciated, and the people that have done so, I am very appreciative of. You will find a button on my Twitter page, a little dollar symbol button, where you can contribute via Venmo or Cash App if you'd like. If PayPal is your thing, find me on PayPal, BrianRSolomon@yahoo.com. And again, thanks to all who have contributed. Also want to mention the wrestling news from Arcadian Vanguard. Find it each and every morning at thewrestlingnews.com or the YouTube page for Arcadian Vanguard. Subscribe if you haven't already. Some of the books I've written, Blood and Fire, the unbelievable real-life story of wrestling's original Sheik, as well as Superheroes, the history of a pop culture phenomenon from Ant-Man to Zorro. You can pick up those books wherever books are sold. If you'd like an autographed copy, reach out to me at BrianRSolomon@yahoo.com. I may have a few still laying around the house. The magazines that I write for, as I mentioned at the top, Inside the Ropes magazine, you can find at InsideTheRopesMagazine.com. Pro Wrestling Illustrated, you will find at PWI-online.com. If you're looking for me on social media, find me on Twitter or Instagram at Brian R. Solomon. And my Facebook writer page is Brian Solomon Writer. And if you're looking for my website out on the World Wide Web, you'll find the link to it on any of those social media platforms. Shut Up and Wrestle is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And as always, this has been Brian R. Solomon asking you to keep those cards and letters coming in and reminding you that the unexamined life is not worth living. But the examined life is no bargain. So long, wrestling fans.